Hello everyone, after a little bit of a lockdown, we're back. Welcome to season 3 of Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Dynamichrome. I'm Peter Moore. Welcome to the Travels Through Time podcast. It's the podcast where we ask one of the world's leading historians to take us back to a year of their choice. They then help us explore that year in 3 different scenes. We've all felt the weight of the past over the last few months. In this first episode of our new season, we're going to be talking about the legacy of William Shakespeare, a poet who for centuries has been helping us to make sense of fraught times like our own. Shakespeare, of course, is England's national poet, but his influence is just as strongly felt in the United States of America, where his plays ranked only second in popularity to the Bible. Shakespeare's legacy in America is the subject of a new book by today's guest. James Shapiro is Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University in New York. He's known as one of the world's leading scholars on Shakespeare's life and plays. James made his name internationally with the suave, perceptive microbiography 1599, which examined a crucial year in the life of the bard. He's since published many more books to look directly at Shakespeare's work, but today we're going to be framing our discussion around his latest publication, Shakespeare in a Divided America. I had a hugely enlightening conversation with Jim about one year in this story a few days ago. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Jim. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you.
It's really a pleasure, Peter.
Right, I'm going to start with some words of Hamlet. And he said, "The purpose of playing, whose end, both at the first and now, was and is to hold, as 'twere the mirror up to nature, to show virtue her feature, scorn her own image, and the very age and body of the time, his form and pressure." Yeah, I'm sure you know those words. They were spoken in particular recently by Oscar Eustace in his opening remarks to his performance of Julius Caesar in Central Park, upon which we may talk a little bit later. But I just wonder, does that quote chime with what you've tried to do in this particular book, which is Shakespeare in a Divided America?
It is. I look at the world, or have for the past 40 years or so, through a Shakespearean lens, which is to say that Shakespeare helps me understand what I'm seeing around me. I read the news, I read the websites from American newspapers, British, foreign, every morning. But it's Shakespeare that allows me to understand the pressure of the time. And Shakespeare himself obviously was somebody who was time traveling all the time, going back to ancient Greece, to ancient Rome, to ancient Britain, to the fairly recent English past. So he's both a model and, in a way, the recurrent challenge to understand the form and pressure of the times.
You're known for studying particular years in depth. And I know, because you write at the start of Shakespeare in America, that you devoted almost a quarter of a century to knowing all that you could about 2 consequential years in Shakespeare's life, which are 1599 and 1606, both of which you've turned into wonderful, enlightening books. As I was saying to you just before we came into this recording studio, they read almost with the fluency of novels. We're not going to visit either of those years today, which may be of a disappointment to some, but as a bit of solace, I thought we would start off with a little bit of Shakespeare directly. I wanted just to ask, of all the magical moments in those 2 particular years, are there any which keep coming back to you, that recur?
One of the things that enabled me to write those books on 1599 and 1606 was keeping a chronology, the day-to-day, so to speak. And that chronology allowed me to see things that I would have otherwise have missed. I'll point to, I suppose, two examples. One is the likelihood that on the eve of Essex's departure with 16,000 troops from England to Ireland to crush Tyrone's rebellion, in all likelihood, Shakespeare's company was at court, and Shakespeare likely heard Lancelot Andrews' stirring sermon warning Essex not to overstep and how to lead his military expedition in the right way. And how those lines ended up feeding directly into Shakespeare's Henry V. That was incredibly exciting for me, probably no less exciting than imagining that Shakespeare and Spenser earlier in that year had crossed paths in London. So the density, the complexity of history really boils down to what happens when two people are in the same room or encounter each other or hear each other. And what you describe as the novelistic aspects of that book, I would just say is a product of immersion, full immersion. And it really took me 15 years to immerse myself in 1599 to the point where I felt that I could speak about what was going on and the pressures of that time with enough confidence to publish. And it took me a little less time, 10 years, to do the same with 1606.
Yeah, I think your choice of Essex's departure to Ireland has set off, well, it's deployed a little memory in my mind of, was this the moment when there was a spectacular summer storm before he left? Did that happen as well, or am I?
Yeah, just when he was marching out of town towards Islington, there was a terrific storm, and people read it as an omen. One of the things that I was, and still am, very much drawn to are not the narratives that appear in history books. I'm not a professional historian, but the things that people respond to, like a spectacular and ominous storm. And I think those are the things that people remember far better than what we call the headlines.
Yeah, I remember that because I think you described it as seen as a great omen. Yeah, it just came rushing back to me as you were describing. So it is in these small moments of history that the past can feel most vivid. But of course, we're not going to look at Shakespeare directly because we're going to concentrate on the later resonance of his plays, which is really the theme of Shakespeare in a divided America. You say that there was a moment, really, you point out that two books above all others have always been popular in America, and that is the Bible and Shakespeare's plays, which almost act like a secular Bible. But there was a moment, particularly in the early 19th century, when his popularity rose. Is that correct?
It is correct. And it's a function of the lack of rivals, really, in the educational system and on the stages of America, but also of the circulation of so many inexpensive copies of his books and the appearance of famous speeches from his plays in what we would think of as oratorical readers, books that people read and studied in order to practice how to speak effectively and powerfully.
So by that, am I to take what we might broadly call the founding generation to have had a lesser interest in Shakespeare, or is that not quite right?
They had a different relationship to Shakespeare. The second president of the United States, John Adams, went with the next president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, on a pilgrimage to Stratford-upon-Avon when they were both in England in order to worship at the shrine. And I think they paid for souvenirs of chips of wood from the chair Shakespeare allegedly sat in Stratford. But John Adams also read the history plays very carefully as a model for the factionalism that he saw inherent in the system he and his quite brilliant colleagues were creating, what we now call the American Republic or democracy. So they turned to Shakespeare in a kind of heady way. I'm much more interested in the kind of Shakespeare that a generation later, men like Abraham Lincoln, who grew up in the prairie, in a log house where he lived his youth, and there were no books. His stepmother came to his household and brought with her a few, and one of them was a reader that had 30 or so speeches of Shakespeare. And Lincoln memorized those speeches and would spend much of the rest of his life reciting them to whoever he could get to listen to them. So it means a lot to me to think of Abraham Lincoln, probably the greatest president in American history, who had to wage a war against a Confederacy that took the lives of perhaps 700,000 soldiers on either side, or both sides, I should say. And this was a man who could quote Hamlet, who could quote Macbeth. And when he read from Macbeth, the tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow speech, said to a friend, "This comes to me as a consolation." So Shakespeare became, in a way, a means through which Americans dealt with the crises, personal and national, that they were experiencing as a young nation in the early 19th century.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to know that about Lincoln's background, and especially in light of the fact that he deployed words so effectively. I'm thinking particularly of the Gettysburg Address, which is like this model of concision. It's less than 300 words. And it's nice
extraordinary.
Yeah, to kind of link that moment back to the young boy in the prairie, maybe with a few books, but one of them being Shakespeare. It's a wonderful connection.
It's so humbling to me because I'm a, if you will, a professional Shakespearean. But Lincoln got those lines in ways that I never will. They touched him. They moved him. He understood them. He kept them close to his heart.
Well, other presidents lie in wait for us today, apart from Lincoln. So let's get on and meet them. I'm going to ask you, Jim Shapiro, the question I ask of everyone who comes on this podcast. If you could travel back through time, what year would you like to visit?
The year I'd like to visit is 1845.
Right. Before we get into our three scenes, because we're going to analyze this one year in three, I hope, really illuminating and instructive scenes. But can you just tell us, we'll do a bit of scene setting. Tell us broadly about 1845. What was going on at this time and what draws you to it in particular?
What draws me to it and what drew me away from writing what I imagine my publishers think of as Rocky III, having written 1599 and 1606. Can you give us 1613, perhaps? I felt after the election of Donald Trump in 2016 that having kept my gaze so steadily fixed on Shakespeare's London in the late 16th or early 17th centuries, I had taken my eyes off the prize and failed to understand something about my own nation and how it got to the sorry place where it now is. And it forced me to do something that I'd never done, which was immerse myself in American history. And I have to say that I still know far more about British history and early modern history in Europe than I do about the past 200 or so years in my own country. And I decided to turn my back, if you will, on looking across the Atlantic and focus on my own nation. And 1845 loomed as an extraordinary year, although if you asked most Americans on the street what 1845 meant to them, they would have very little idea. But for me, the year is the moment in American history where the nation came to a fork in the road and could have chosen one path or could have chosen the other. And as fate would have it, it chose to go down a path that leads very much to the moment in which we are now living. The kind of growing confidence economically and in other ways America was feeling at this time meant that less attention was being paid to what I think of as the two primal sins of my nation. One was slavery, and the other was the treatment of the indigenous people in this country. And in 1845, the decisions that were made changed the course of both of those stories in an irreversible way.
What a wonderful setup. So let's go from that description to your first scene. Where would you like to go to first, please?
Summer, July, August of 1845. And that was the year that, how would I put it, what had been felt but never so well expressed was perfectly captured by an American writer of Irish descent, John O'Sullivan, who was an editor of the Democratic Review. And in the summer issue of that review in 1845, he coined the phrase Manifest Destiny. And Manifest Destiny, which was quickly picked up everywhere from Congress to newspapers, captured the feeling that had been growing in recent times. And I might as well just define what Manifest Destiny is. It's the notion that, and I'll quote O'Sullivan here, the boundless future will be the era of American greatness. And he opposed anyone, and I'll quote again, thwarting our policy and hampering our power, limiting our greatness, and checking the fulfillment of our manifest destiny to overspread the continent allotted by Providence for the free development of our yearly multiplying millions.
Mm. It's and really...
Those were extraordinary words.
They are. I mean, it's we have these moments in history, don't we, when there's something latent in the culture, which sometimes hasn't yet been given a name, and then along will come a newspaper or, in more recent age, it might be a television presenter or whatever, and they'll just find a language that expresses that latent feeling so perfectly. I remember a few years ago in a seminar class I was taking during this period of, I suppose, popular uprisings in the Middle East, and we were thinking, what are historians going to call this? And, we hadn't quite got to the point of the Arab Spring being expressed. But it soon was. And of course we have the credit crunch, or even in a different realm you have Beatlemania or something like that,
or Black Lives Matter at this moment.
Yeah, that would be the closest thing we have to it today. But was this particular two-word phrase, Manifest Destiny, was it picked up on very quickly, or is it something that subsequently historians have used to define the time?
Both, really, but it was picked up very quickly. There were two hotspots, if you will, geopolitically at this moment, that were at the center of what was behind Manifest Destiny. One was the crisis in the Pacific Northwest between America and Britain, and who would lay claim to what had, since the War of 1812, been a divided territory where both Americans and Brits could live and work under the presidency of a rather indistinguished American president, Polk. He made it part of his campaign to insist that America would claim the Pacific Northwest and challenge Britain for that land. And at the same time, in this kind of aggressive way, Polk was insistent on the annexation of Texas, which was not simply a land grab extending from Texas to Southern California that would push the boundaries of America further west, but it was also a way to increase the number of slave states and tip the balance that would lead us into a civil war in 1860. So this was extremely consequential, but these are the two locales. We were just making a decision. Were we going to remain as a nation a republic, or would we be effectively an empire with global ambitions and believe that we had the God-given right to snatch whatever land we wanted from sea to shining sea?
And this is, obviously, it barely needs pointing out, a completely Shakespearean moment, isn't it? There's a decision to be made. What course are you going to take? So that's the first thing we should point out. But then the second, I suppose, is more of a historical nature, which is that today we are so familiar with the shape of the United States of America. It seems so solid and concrete in our minds that It's strange to think back to a time when its boundaries were not really defined, and it could have gone this way and it could have gone that. The summer of 1845 seems exactly as you describe it to be, the moment when it decided that it was going to become this coast-to-coast country. And were ambitions even further than that? I don't know.
For me, when I hear John L. O'Sullivan's words and hearing him as a cheerleader for American exceptionalism, I hear the echoes of his language in the speeches of Donald Trump today and of a large segment of the American populace who truly believe in this expansionist, imperialist, God-given nation. But in 1845, that was not yet a done deal, and it could have gone another way, but didn't.
You mention in the book an example from a particular erudite member of the House, I think from Massachusetts, who replies to this concept of manifest destiny, which is gathering momentum at that time, with some lines of caution from the play of King John. Do you want to say something about that?
Sure. Robert Charles Winthrop, who was a member of the House of Representatives from Massachusetts, an opponent of slavery, as many from the Northeast was, who strongly opposed this annexation of Texas. And his way of doing it was to quote from what is now one of the less well-known Shakespeare plays, but in the 19th century was quite popular, and that's King John. And he stood up in Congress and he quoted the speech from King John about the kind of braggart, swagger figure that Shakespeare mocks so effectively. And here's what he quoted. "Here's a loud mouth, here's a large mouth indeed, that spits forth death and mountains, rocks and seas, talks as familiarly of roaring lions as maids of 13 do of puppy dogs. What cannoneer begot this lusty blood? He speaks plain cannon fire and smoke and bounce." And what Winthrop was trying to do was say to his opponents who were promoting slavery, promoting the going to war with Britain over the Pacific Northwest, he was just really calling them out and saying that for all their swagger, they were not willing to risk their own lives. Mm. And these were claims more easily made than defended by those who were making them.
Absolutely. And in an interesting example of how discourse has shifted over time, I think if we were to distill that little speech into 21st century idiom, you'd come out with something like the word chicken hawk. Is that right? That wonderful description of people who are quite happy to start wars, but then don't want to fight in them themselves.
And we've seen enough of that in the last 30 years of our lives.
Absolutely. So I think, how would we characterize this moment in the summer of 1845? I suppose it's a moment of which to us today is quite, I suppose, unfamiliar in a sense, because I think that we are living of a time when we're more questioning of our role in the world, particularly what we've done to the planet and what the future is going to hold for us. But at this moment, I think it seems that O'Sullivan is expressing a great deal of confidence that the country has been successful so far, but it's only a small element of what it could be in the future if it follows this manifest destiny, which I think you've expressed really well. So it's a very interesting...
Well, my one regret is that Shakespeare wasn't alive in 1848 to write about 1845, because he would have seen the hubris of this and the arrogance and the hyper-masculinity that betrayed deeper anxieties, to put it in contemporary terms, not in Shakespearean language. So it's a perfect Shakespearean moment where those who are so brimming with confidence about our ability to bully our opponents and snatch what we could with God's smiling support, had no idea what the consequences of their decisions would be. Unspoken in Manifest Destiny is, we're going to get rid of the Native Americans. They stand in the way of our westward expansion. It wasn't just the British and the Mexicans that were at the heart of Manifest Destiny, but it was, we're going to solve our Indian problem. We're just going to either kill or drive them into Canada or create reservations. So this was really, to me, the saddest part of what Manifest Destiny, if you will, achieved, which was the destruction of Native American culture that was so vibrant at that time. And of course, as everyone knew in debates about the annexation of Texas, this wasn't about Mexico. This was whether America would be a slave-holding nation or not. Everyone on both sides really understood that was what this fight was about. So to believe in Manifest Destiny was to believe that you could destroy the Native American population and that you could perpetuate slavery. And it, again, it didn't have to go that way, but that's what happened.
Hello, I'm Peter. At Travels Through Time, we're incredibly proud to be partnering with Jordan Lloyd, who's one of the world's leading visual historians. His extraordinary photo colorization work has appeared on the covers of National Geographic, Life, and People magazine. And the quality of his work and his attention to detail really has to be seen to be believed. There are portraits of Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln. There are sweeping panoramas of scenes like the D-Day beaches. And one of my own personal favourites is a colourised shot of RMS Titanic at that moment when she's cutting loose from her moorings in Southampton in April 1912. Travels Through Time listeners can now buy any one of these brilliant prints at a discount at his website, colourgraph.co. Just enter the discount code TTT and get 10% off any order. Your second scene follows the first, but in a more practical way, and it introduces, on top of this really good contextual understanding we've got of the time now, a little bit of comedy maybe, a lot of activity, and we're introduced to a familiar character in a very unfamiliar way. So do you want to tell us where you would like to go to for your second scene, please?
I'm going to the Mexican-American border, and I'm going to a small town called Corpus Christi, which at that time only had about 200 souls living there, a trading outpost in Texas near the border. And in the summer of 1845, even as this phrase Manifest Destiny is being coined, half of the United States Army is being sent to the Mexican border, either to provoke a war with Mexico or to invade Mexico or to force Mexico into some kind of exchange of money for land. It was unclear. The army leaders themselves did not know what their orders were. And of course, if you send thousands of troops into this desolate area and give them nothing to do, they'll soon fall into fighting and gambling and drinking. And one of the officers famously described Corpus Christi that summer as the most murderous, thieving, gambling, cutthroat, godforsaken hole in Texas, which must have been something. So the officers trying to prevent their soldiers from killing each other, I suppose, or getting into worse trouble, decided to build a theater, an 800-seat theater for these 4,000 troops. And they fell to work, and in the fall of the autumn of 1845, they started rehearsing plays. And one of the first plays that they rehearsed was Shakespeare's Othello, which on the face of it, if you think, why choose a play that is about a black man marrying a white woman in this fraught moment? One of the things that I learned was Othello was one of the most popular plays in the South at this time, that slave holders would name slaves Othello. We know that from runaway slave records at this time, looking for Othello. And the officers decided again to perform this play, all male cast, since there are no women available to play women's roles. And most of these men had known each other at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And although 15, 20 years later, they would be on opposite sides in the Civil War, they were a very tight-knit group at this time. And pretty quickly, they found an actor to play Othello, Theodoric Porter, probably played in blackface or darkening his skin in one way or another. And they cast about to find an actor to play Desdemona. And it wasn't easy. And the first one they chose was a fairly extraordinary man, James Longstreet, who fought for the Confederacy and then after the defeat in the Civil War, turned around and sided against those who were still promoting the lost cause of the South and racism at that time. But Longstreet was not a good fit for Desdemona. He was about 6'1". He was a football player. He was just too big for the part. So they looked around and they found another officer and friend of theirs who was 5'7", 135 pounds, and had a kind of girlish modesty. And as Longstreet, in an interview long after this, recalled, he looked very like a girl dressed up. And that man was Ulysses S. Grant, the leader of the Union forces that defeated the South in the Civil War, and later the 18th President of the United States. The guy who stares at us from $50 bills in America is that bearded fellow. But at the time, he really was clean-shaven, girlish-looking, long hair. And again, everybody thought he would really fit the part of Desdemona.
Wow, so much to unpack in this scene. When did you first come across this detail of Grant playing Desdemona?
Michael Dobson at the Shakespeare Institute in Stratford-upon-Avon mentioned this to me, and I thought, wow, this is, I just don't believe this. And he said, just contact the archives at the University of Southern California, and they'll send you the original information from Longstreet's testimony. And I did, and they were very helpful. Probably spent 6 months of my life learning everything I could about the theatrics that accompanied the encampment at Corpus Christi and all the characters involved. So that was a really exciting for me moment, in part because you're right, it has a little bit of humor. It's unpredictable. Shakespeare's at the heart of it. But it captured all the, for me, key issues, which were what constitutes manliness, who's comfortable with what kind of manly behavior, on the eve of a war in which a greater percentage of American soldiers would die fighting than any war America has ever fought. Mm-hmm. So the idea of this future hero of the Civil War and future president of the United States rehearsing the part of Desdemona, dressed in a woman's dress, is extraordinary, especially if you think of a contemporary president doing the same. It's actually unimaginable. Mm. Yet at the time, this happened.
Well, we can't even get your
sad things.
Yeah, we can't get your president to put a mask on, let alone get dressed as Desdemona. That's a boundary too far. But there's a quote here. I think this was written early in the 20th century in memoirs, but it says that young Grant had a girl's primness of manner and modesty of conduct. There was a broad streak of the feminine in his personality. He was almost half woman, but the strand was buried in the depths of his soul. Now, if you were to repeat that quote to British audiences, and we have listeners from America and Britain and lots of other places, but for our British audiences, I think it might be interesting to play that against what people think of when they think of Grant today. Is that completely at odds?
It is completely at odds. And one of the things that America is wrestling with at this moment is how we regard these heroes or icons or leading figures of our past. one of the sadder things to me in the attempt to rewrite American history is, in addition to rightly tearing down the statues of Confederate figures that were erected in the early 20th century to instill fear among the Black populations of the South, there was an act of tearing down Ulysses S. Grant's statue in San Francisco about a week or so ago. And that saddened me, not because he's collateral damage to a justified social movement, but because people don't really understand who Ulysses S. Grant was. And these are not things that subsequent biographers have emphasized. And I should say that Grant understood, even though he was quite a young man at this time, that the foray into Mexico was disastrous. And the way he put it was, what started at Corpus Christi and ended at Appomattox at the end of the Civil War that defeated the South was avoidable. The Southern Rebellion, he wrote, was largely the outgrowth of the Mexican War. Nations like individuals are punished for their transgressions. We got our punishment in the most sanguinary and expensive war of modern times. So for all his girlishness, for all his theatrics, he also understood that the battle he was being sent to fight in Mexico would end up costing America greatly. Yeah. So I have tremendous respect for Grant.
Yeah, and that's why this scene, I mean, if we were to go along to the rehearsals and sit on that front row to watch, that's why it would be so utterly transfixing, because you've got the micro scene, which is, I suppose, a character study of an unfamiliar side of someone who we think we know rather well. And then you've got the through line. This is the big historical events, which takes you, you know, a decade and a half into the future to the turmoil of everything that we know that happened then. So it would be transfixing for all of those reasons.
I should say, so that listeners don't imagine, that Grant actually got to perform the role. Lieutenant Porter, who was playing Othello, decided that he could not generate what he called enough sentiment for Desdemona with Grant in the role. And for all that he had rehearsed the role and dressed up in Desdemona's dress, the company decided to send to the nearby New Orleans for a professional actress, Mrs. Hart, to play the role of Desdemona. So a heartbroken Ulysses S. Grant never got to perform what he had rehearsed. But even the resistance of Porter to this cross-dressed performance tells you about how deep the anxieties ran. Once you stirred up and in a way put on stage the issues that this nation was confronting, issues of race, issues of manliness.
And I think that's what you speak to when you write. There's a quite insightful passage, or just a couple of lines really, when you say, Grant never wrote about his experiences performing at the Army Theatre. Still, a future general and president saw the world through the eyes of a white woman in love with a black man. Curiously, it was around this time that the clean-shaven Grant decided at long last to grow a beard. Now, yeah, we can put those things together in different ways, but yeah, it's an interesting point to make that, of course, the process of acting is about empathy for character. And it does make you imagine, doesn't it, what ideas kindled in Grant's mind at that time?
I think about that all the time, although I resist as a historian trying to fantasize a bit too much. Placing myself at that moment in time gives me a clearer sense, really, of what was at stake and what the fault lines were. And Shakespeare really enables me to do that in a way that reading, say, conventional histories cannot.
Well, we've got one more scene to explore. And can you take us to it, please? What's your third scene in the year 1845?
I just come in under the very limit of 1845. It's the last week of the year. It's late December 1845. And it is a production of Romeo and Juliet, and it is being staged in London. And its lead performers are American siblings. Of course, British papers are filled with news about the Pacific Northwest. There's a lot of anti-American hostility. It's not an ideal time for a pair of American siblings to be coming to London to perform in Shakespeare, national poet. But this was something that the actor playing Romeo had been preparing for the past decade. And it was a spectacular, spectacular success. So much so that it performed night after night into the following year. Queen Victoria herself came to see the production, and it was one of the most famous productions.
Most famous productions of the 19th century. Who was this character, this alluring character who played Romeo?
The character was an American named Charlotte Cushman. The part of Juliet was played by her younger sister, Susan. This was a cross-dressed Romeo. And in a way, the same issues that we've been talking about concerning gender and power and manliness with Grant and even with Manifest Destiny played out on the English stage as well at this moment. The male actors who tried to play Romeo failed in the part. And by the middle of the 19th century, that failure was extraordinary. So you really had a choice. Don't stage one of Shakespeare's most popular plays or find somebody who could play Romeo. And one actor after another crashed and burned in the role. And what emerged was the problem of Romeo is you have to be able to pick up a sword, kill Tybalt aggressively and be masculine at those moments. And at other moments of the play, you have to fall in Friar Lawrence's cell and sob and be in the terms of the play, effeminate, as the friar calls Romeo in that scene. So male actors could not straddle the competing demands of a kind of aggressive manliness and a kind of feminine side that you captured in your description of Grant. Cushman, who is a lesbian, quite intimidating and formidable, was able to straddle both of those roles and perform the Romeo that no man at the time was able to do.
Yeah, I was surprised that I'd never heard her name before you told me about her and I read about her in your book because, well, I think you point out in your book that she doesn't really fit into the tradition of American history as it is now. So she's a bit out of fashion. But I think in the book you make plain that you think she ranks as one of the greatest Shakespearean actors there has ever been. Is that right?
There's no question. She ranks as one of the greatest American Shakespeare actors and internationally one of the great 19th century actors. I would put her in my top 15 or so greatest Shakespeare actors of all time. But she had to be written out of history because her life story and her roles could not easily be accommodated into what we'd like to think about Shakespeare on stage or we'd like to think about our celebrities.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot we can talk about when we dive into her biography. You describe her not just on the stage, and we'll talk about a few anecdotes in a moment, but also off the stage. She resembled, in a way, I don't know if you saw, there was a British drama called Gentleman Jack, which was broadcast by the BBC last year, which told the life of Anne Lister, a member of the gentry up in Yorkshire. But she was completely novel at the time for her habit of dressing like a man, behaving like a man, not conforming to any of the ideas that the Victorians had of womanhood and sitting at home in a drawing room with the sewing and all of that. And it seemed to me that Charlotte Cushman did much the same. She was someone who dressed in a way which transgressed all the boundaries to the point that rather than being, I suppose, shamed, you might say, by the contemporary culture, she was accepted as a wonderful eccentric. She was someone who did what she wanted to do. She wasn't going to be told. And for that reason, I think she really jumps out of the page.
She jumps out of the page. She is a century ahead of her time, if not more. She is herself. She knew herself. She was very thoughtful, if not cagey, about how she prepared for this moment. And she drove critics mad, those who were threatened by the idea of what they call this hybrid she-Romeo, because it clearly undermined their notions of, let's just say, unfluid gender, of clear roles for men and women. And she really captured the tensions between an anachronistic notion of what women were or could be and what they would be later in the century, and certainly over fights for the right to vote and equal pay and the rest. I don't want to put too much on Cushman's back, but she was very conscious of all of these issues. She also knew how to win audiences over. My absolute favorite anecdote about her was when she was playing Romeo back in the States some years later up in Boston. And when she was in the balcony scene making love to a young Juliet, her Juliets kept getting younger and younger after she first played with her sister. A man in the audience snorted at the moment where they were making love in the balcony scene. And Charlotte Cushman stopped the performance, walked to the front of the stage, and called out this man, challenging him to a fight. And he fled the theater. The audience went wild, cheering for her. She escorted her Juliet back on stage and continued performing. Whether she was still in character or there was very little line between her character and her actual personality, I don't know and I don't care. But it was a moment that encapsulates Charlotte Cushman's understanding of theater, understanding of her own autonomy and power. And people at the time knew it. When she died, there was tremendous outpouring of grief. But of course, again, she can't be easily accommodated into the story we tell either of Shakespeare in performance or the story we tell of American heroes.
Hmm. At the time, I suppose, there was a reverse system in place to what we have today when British actors kind of have to go to Hollywood to make it. I think at this time, is it fair to say that for American actors, they had to come over to Britain, and playing in the Haymarket Theatre in the West End of London, that was a big ticket, wasn't it?
It was, and it was either success or terrible failure. And Cushman really rolled the dice at that moment. She knew that there were too few great roles for women in Shakespeare. She had been through all the breeches parts, playing Rosalind, playing Jessica. She had played Lady Macbeth to the leading American and British actors of her day. But she also understood that unless she was playing Hamlet and Romeo, she would never get the acknowledgement. Nowadays, we have leading women on both sides of the Atlantic playing Richard II or Lear or Hamlet. And these are extraordinary performances. But in her day, she was really at the cutting edge of breaking those boundaries.
You've got two pictorial illustrations of her in the book. The first is a photograph which seems rather sedate, which belies this presence that she must have. But there's a wonderful woodcut from the London Evening News. Is it the Illustrated London News? I'll get it right.
It is, yeah.
And it just catches this dynamic force of her. And I really like that. I'll have to see, actually, because it's out of copyright. We might even be able to put it up on the website. So maybe
You should. And both of them are out of copyright. They're wonderful images because in the photograph, she looks... And she's wearing the same costume in both images. She looks stodgy, I don't know, like a school crossing guard. There's no charisma. There's no
That's a lollipop sexiness. Lady in English.
There you go. And in the image that appeared in the British press, she has a smoldering gaze as she's staring at Juliet, who's mesmerized by that look. And her waist is thin. Her hair is tossed wildly. She just looks like the great romantic Romeo even if it is a touch ambiguous about is she a man or a woman in the scene. And that just tells you that when we go to the theater, we see what actors get us to believe in. And I no more trust the photograph as evidence of who Charlotte Cushman was than I do, if you will, that image in the London Illustrated News.
There's a nice scene that you quote many years later on when she's invited to the White House when Grant is president. And I'll let you pick up the story.
It's on the eve of Grant's second inaugural address. And she's a superstar. She's a global celebrity. And she does what she wants. And she came down to Washington, D.C. to perform Shakespeare in, and this is quite later in her career, after the Civil War, obviously. She's performing in D.C., and the President of the United States came to see her perform and then sent a note saying he'd love to meet with her backstage after. And it gives you a sense of how big a celebrity she was, because she just sent the note back saying she didn't care to talk to him. And she wrote to a friend later that week, I just wasn't curious. I had no curiosity to speak to the man. And as a kind of cultural historian, it saddens me, because you can only imagine what a great conversation it might have been between the greatest female Romeo of the day and this man who, in the early stages of his life, had played Desdemona in Corpus Christi rehearsals, at least. They would have had a lot to talk about.
That's a great what if. Right. Before we head back to our present times, I've got one last question for you. And that is, if you could bring a tangible memento of your travels today from the year 1845 back with you, is there anything that you would like?
What I would really love, although it's probably physically impossible, is a recording of Ulysses S. Grant speaking Desdemona's lines early in the play, when Desdemona is asked whether she loves Othello. And she says, that I love the more to live with him, my downright violence and storm of fortunes may trumpet to the world. My heart subdued even to the very quality of my lord, I saw Othello's visage in his mind. And I would really give anything to have a tape of Ulysses S. Grant saying those words. Flat Midwestern accent there, in a slightly girlish, high-pitched voice.
Wow. Are all times Shakespearean, or are some times more Shakespearean than others?
That's a wonderful, wonderful question, one that I don't really get asked very often, if at all. I would say there are moments of great urgency where Shakespeare, or one play or another of Shakespeare, seems to speak to us more powerfully than it might have earlier on in our lives or earlier on in the theatrical history of that play. And you began by mentioning Oscar Eustace's production of Julius Caesar in Central Park in the summer of 2017, where a Trumpian Caesar is assassinated on stage. That, to me, captured the urgency of that moment. And I do believe right now, between Black Lives Matter and coronavirus and elections that are so consequential in my country, that we are living through as Shakespearean a moment as I've ever lived through.
Well, I don't think we can take this too much further. Thank you very much, James Shapiro.
It's been a great, great pleasure speaking to you.
That was me, Peter Moore, talking to Professor James Shapiro. Please head to our website, tttpodcast.com, to see pictures that show Charlotte Cushman and a swashbuckling Ulysses S. Grant. And there's also some fascinating materials that we've found that relate to this idea of manifest destiny. You'll also, and this is a bit of a treat, find a superb colorized image of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., whilst it's under construction in the year 1846, so just 1 year out. It's made by Jordan at Dynamochrome, and it's a great representation of the American nation being built. Remember, if you head to colorgraph.co, you can get prints of this image for yourself. And don't forget to use that discount code, which is TTT. That'll get you 10% off everything. Of course, the perfect place to head if you're engrossed by today's conversation is to the bookshop. James Shapiro's book is called Shakespeare in a Divided America. It's published by Faber in the UK and by Penguin Press in the USA. It's available for purchase now. This is a special week for us here at Travels Through Time. We're really pleased to be back after our enforced break, and we have not just one, but two fascinating conversations for you. The second is also available right now on our feed. It's with the brilliant young scholar, Luke Papera, who's taking my colleague Artemis on an epic and little known journey into African history. Please do check that out. Remember, there's a whole catalogue of episodes available on our website, tttpodcast.com. We're on Twitter as well, if you want to follow along, at tttpodcast_. And that's it. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.